Hello and welcome to Music Works, a podcast by Polyphony Arts. We're talking about the future of the classical music industry with some great guests. Thank you for joining us. Hello and welcome to Music Works, a podcast by Polyphony Arts. I'm Katie Beardsworth and this week I'm talking to Alistair Hogarth about all things professional music and in particular what professional musicians can be doing to help themselves and to promote themselves during lockdown and as we come out of lockdown. This is something that Al and I have been talking about on our Facebook Live series for a while. We've had a couple of sessions talking about that already, so we're going to carry on the conversation on this podcast today. Welcome, Al. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Hey, thanks for having me. What a joy. What an honour. Yeah, I'm Al. I am a pianist and I direct a group called The Prince Consort, which is it's like a flexible collective of singers, and I play the piano with them. It's sort of a focus on piano accompanied song, really, and that's what most of my career has been. We began by doing quite sort of standard core repertoire, and we were fortunate enough to be able to do a lot at the Wigmore Hall and, you know, on BBC Radio 3. And then sort of about 10 or 12 years in, we started to do slightly more wacky projects and collaborations with other artists. So we collaborated with poets, we commissioned people, we did a lot of commissioning. We worked with other musicians. So we worked with people like Jason Rebello, that was really fun, the jazz pianist. And then more recently, we've been, you know, through those kind of collaborations and because of them and because they're, you know, often an interesting thing to film, we've done a lot more sort of digital stuff with Classic FM, which is always a joy to work with those guys. So yeah, it's been a fun career. I'm also really into teaching at the moment. I think not just because of lockdown and everyone has to say, oh, I'm really into teaching now, but I have been for the last sort of 5 or 6 years. I suppose all my life, but in particular in the last 5 or 6 years with sort of college level students and helping them both with playing and singing, but also with their career development and how to sort of become a musician at the moment. So that's me.
Great. Yeah, absolutely. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this because, you know, we have such a lot to say about this, don't we? About how...
Yeah,
it is, absolutely. And so we were... in our previous discussions about this, it's been interesting because we obviously started, as lockdown started, you know, people reacted. And then I feel as though there might have been a little period of maybe status quo almost in the middle, not a very long one. And I feel as though now we're in another transitional period, actually, as lockdown lifts, but not completely. And there may not be strictly, you know, guidelines that say we can't perform in public, but there are practical reasons why performances in public are still limited and so on and so forth. So yeah, an interesting time I think to be having another conversation about the impact of this on musicians and their careers.
I think it really is. And one thing that I found very interesting throughout this whole pandemic and the various stages of lockdown is that each different stage imposes a different kind of limitation artistically on what you can do. So at the beginning, obviously, it was absolutely impossible to get together with another musician. So we had all those kind of split screen collaborations with, you know, one person in Boston and then another person in China performing together. And it sounding, you know, a lot of the time absolutely brilliant. And I think this period that we're in right now is another one of those odd kind of limbo phases. I've maybe mentioned this before to you, but I love this quote by Michael Caine, the actor, and his favourite quote, I think, is "use the difficulty." And I think it was a director that told him it. He was sort of mid-production, and I think he had to enter the stage basically after there'd been a fight. So he had to enter the stage via this door, and there'd been this big fight, and there'd been furniture lobbed around and all that kind of stuff. And unbeknownst to Michael Caine, there'd been a chair leg or something thrown down and it blocked the door and he couldn't get in. And he sort of tried to get in and obviously couldn't do anything about it and sort of stuck his head around and said to the director, well, what shall I do? And the director said to him, well, use the difficulty. You know, if it's a drama, smash the door down and throw the chair leg in rage. If it's a comedy, trip over the chair leg. So I love that thought, not only for performance, if something goes wrong, as it often does, especially in my performances, but just in life and in art. I think it's often limitations that create really cool stuff. And I mean, an example of this, we could chat about this if you like in a bit, but the one major thing I worked on in lockdown was a commission with Stephen Huff. And that the idea behind that was to create something specifically for lockdown that could have a life afterwards. So this sort of thing, hopefully we've successfully managed to create this thing that can span, you know, both within lockdown and beyond it. But I think the current situation, you know, getting back to that, again, it's another limitation, but it's an interesting one. You know, we can perform together if you're performing with a duo or whatever, provided you're distanced. But there's either no audience or a socially distanced audience that brings with it its own challenges, both, I think, for the performers and the listeners. We're seeing amazing stuff continually coming out online, and actually one of the most fantastic things I've been enjoying this last week has been the Edinburgh International Festival broadcast. Yeah. I don't know if you managed to catch any of those.
No, not yet, but I've been seeing what they are.
I tune into some of those. And firstly, what struck me is it's beautifully filmed, very simple but beautifully filmed, like really high quality. And the major thing that came across was the balance and the sound was absolutely perfect. And it got to the end, actually, and I sort of thought, I wonder who did the sound. And it was Philip Hobbs, who's the main guy at Lynn, who's been the engineer for two of my albums with them and actually the producer of one as well. So that's why the sound is so terrific. So I really enjoyed those. And again, it was without audience, but that was a real highlight for me. But seeing performers together again, and of course the Wigmore stuff that they're putting out is also equally wonderful. It's a funny time, and you have to manage other difficulties. Like, you know, for example, with the Wigmore stuff, people were having to decide, well, how do I walk on if I walk onto stage to no audience? What do? Do you just sort of walk on and start, or are you on stage to begin with and just start, or, you know, all these funny little things around each situation kind of color it a bit, and I think that's nice.
Yeah, it is, and I think you're right, like seeing all of these things as an opportunity to do something different or to do something interesting or just to do something great is such a great attitude. And I know that all of these transitions have brought challenges for musicians, and I know at first there was the do I don't I produce music online, and I think then that felt to me from the people I was talking to as though people started to resolve that in their own minds one way or another, sort of work out where they sat within that. And now with being able to be in spaces again together, it's almost like in some ways people feel that it's up the game, in the sense that you suddenly do have the ability to produce music in the same room as each other. So the split screen thing isn't necessarily necessary anymore, although obviously in some cases it is if somebody is particularly vulnerable or if it's a large group or, you know, yep, for whatever reason. And then you start to think, and I've heard, you know, a lot of the people that I speak to, you know, clients and musicians have said things like, oh, you know, I don't have the budget for like an incredible filmmaker, because obviously as soon as you, and venues obviously opening as well, so the potential is there to hire an amazing venue and hire an amazing filmmaker and make an amazing film, but then, you know, that's all cost, and, you know, what is it for, and so on and so forth. And I think again, the almost in a way, the more opportunities are available to people in terms of the more options, the more complicated the decisions get, because there was sort of a time when it was simple. And I think, I don't know if this is how everyone feels, but that's how it felt to me as I've been talking to people, is at first people didn't know what to do because it was all new and completely different. And then there was a little hiatus where we were like, okay, we know what's available to us. We know what we can do. We can either choose to do it or not. And then it's all kind of become, again, lots of options and people sort of finding their way. And other things are starting to appear as well, like subscription music channels. I mean, they've always been there. Things like Medici TV and things like that have always existed, but they're starting to things. I think the Royal Opera House have created a subscription channel. I'm not sure if that was all, again, always available in that format, but there's a sort of sense that the model through which you try and sell music is starting to adapt to the online market as well. So I think, you know, we're seeing all those shifts. And as we've gone through, we've kind of talked about the things that people or musicians would be thinking about under these circumstances. And it's also, I think, as I've realised that we're recording this now on the 28th of August, and this, it won't be released for some time. At this point, I haven't fixed the launch date for the podcast, so may as well be frank about that. So it may be that when this comes out, the situation is different again. So it's worth thinking about. But I think, you know, as lockdown continues to lift and the planned performances start to happen, we'll continue to see this develop, and it is possible to see how it'll go.
I wonder whether something that might be interesting, I mean, this is an awful thing to say as well, but I don't mean it in this way, but it will be interesting. It'd be also dreadful if it happened, but if there were to be a second lockdown or a second wave, tragic obviously as that would be, it will also be, I think it would be a challenge to see, you know, how do people deal with that as musicians and promoters and whatever, because you can go back, but I'm not sure whether people will. I can't see, if we have a second lockdown, people going back to those split screen remote performances. Do you know what I mean? What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. I mean, I agree about going back, and I certainly think we've all learned a lot from the first lockdown. There's certainly a lot that I would have done differently just in my general life setup if I'd known what it was going to be like in my first lockdown, such as making sure I had some grandparents on site immediately.
Yeah,
exactly, that would have been the main one. I think it's interesting to come back to what you were saying about your project with Stephen Huff, and I'd love to hear more about that. Another project that I'm working on with one of my clients is that they're looking at a kind of latency embracing composition. I think this is not, it's not unique to them. I think there are people who are thinking about this. So like a piece that's actually possible to perform on a platform like Zoom or Skype. And it does, you know, the fact that the latency or the time delay between the people in different rooms doesn't actually matter, like the composition embraces that. That's part of it.
That's exactly what we did.
Yeah, is it? Right. Well, there you go, you see. So, you know, yeah. I think this is, it's about, you know, the shift being less about making music despite all the challenges and more about saying, okay, this is the situation that we're in. You know, what great music can we make in this situation? Tell me more about the piece by Stephen Huff and the project there.
Yeah, so the piece with Stephen, one of the amazing things was that he wrote it so very quickly, and that was amazing in itself to have this piece suddenly made for you, and very sort of appropriate for the time. I think one of my major thoughts was that one of the big issues with all the wonderful performances I'd seen, well, there were issues with those performances, but one of the challenges that people were facing was that they obviously couldn't really do a live performance together as a duo on one platform. So it was always sort of two different things edited together. So my first thought was I'd love to create something that bakes that into the composition. So yeah, it's very much the same as what you were just mentioning. So Stephen came up with this wonderful idea. Well, before I tell you the idea, the other thought that we had when we were sort of discussing it was that we wanted a piece that would live beyond the pandemic and be able to be performed afterwards and make sense. So basically a piece that would completely be practical for online performance, but could also absolutely live afterwards and make sense too in that environment. So, you know, one or the other didn't feel weird. So it actually felt like a sort of transitioning piece in a way.
Sure.
So what we did, we found some texts by Rumi, And the whole cycle is called Songs from Isolation. And Stephen sort of adapted texts by Rumi that were sort of on the kind of topic or topics around all the sort of things that we've all been feeling in lockdown and this whole thing. And he wrote it in such a way that there were, so it's for tenor and piano, and he wrote three songs. What happens is if you perform the thing in its entirety, perform the piece in its entirety, you get, there's three solo songs. So literally just for tenor. So no accompaniment, they're unaccompanied a cappella. First song, second song, third song. And then you hear three piano pieces that are completely solo piano pieces. So obviously there's no issue with lag or online issues if you're performing that on something like Skype. And then what happens is you suddenly realize there's another three songs, and you realize that the first song that the singer sang fits above the first piano piece, and that becomes another thing. So then there's these three songs that have the singer and voice, the singer and piano at the same time. So the idea is, the idea I think that Stephen wrote in the little bit of blurb that he wrote at the beginning of the music was, the idea is you can rehearse your own music and it can form a piece in itself for you when you're in lockdown. But then when lockdown eases, you can get together with your singer or your pianist and perform these things as a duo. So that was the sort of transition-y aspect to it. So obviously you can also sort of muck around with the format of that and either just perform the songs as piano and voice, or you can do just the solo piano pieces if you're just doing a piano recital or whatever. So I felt it was really super adaptable, and I was pleased it was something that can live afterwards. And actually we chose in the end not to record it in lockdown. We're going to record it quite soon, but we're going to do that all in person now. Just as a slightly different thing, you know, here's something that we created, or that Stephen created in lockdown, that we're now performing after it. So just a slightly different angle really, but that's the sort of basics of it really.
Oh, that's wonderful. I absolutely love that concept, and particularly nice to have piano accompaniments or pieces, see, like, you know, showcase as standalone pieces as well, because I do always feel that piano accompanists in song are basically the most important people in the world and not necessarily
well,
always.
Well, we are. Right?
Well, absolutely.
That's what I was told.
Yeah. So it sounds like a fantastic project. So it's not been recorded yet at all? Have you been rehearsing it then on your own with the singer? Who's the singer?
It's Andrew Staples.
Oh, lovely.
Who I've worked with for years, and we've done so many sort of fun and funky different projects. So he's super creative to work with. So we wanted to wait and just really think through how we were going to do it and take our time. Because I think the instinct as well in lockdown that I've found is it's very easy to just want to put material out very quickly and, you know, panic and just, you know, I've got to keep my profile and all this kind of stuff. But we just wanted to take our time over it and really consider how we're going to release it. And, yeah, we just wanted to make sure we're doing it in a way that we feel is the best way to present it in a way. And I think, yeah, we just wanted to kind of take our time over that. But we'll record it quite soon, so we will release that in due course.
Did you decide that once the opportunity had come for you to be in a space together? You know, did you sort of see that coming and say, actually, let's not do it like this week, let's do it in a few weeks when, you know, that's been established? Or had you always felt that it would be better to...
Well, at first it took a few weeks to decide exactly where we wanted to place it and how we would place it, and would we link, for example, a video performance of it, if we were to actually record it remotely, would we link that to a venue or a festival or whatever, in which case that would take some time to set up. Also, because a lot of the venues and promoters were unsure of what was happening next, everything just took a little bit longer at that period. And because of that, and through no one's fault, we then got to the stage where things did start to open up, and the everything changed a bit. And as things, because then things started to change quite frequently. So we then kind of, yeah, then we decided to just wait it out a little bit and see, because things started to move quite quickly in a more positive direction. So it was sort of half, I'd like to say from the very beginning, we always decided. But it was,
I mean,
it was
we all know that's not how these things
as,
work.
Yeah, it's very much as we were going. Yeah.
Yeah. Change. That's interesting. It's interesting. I feel like, again, I just think that there's something about seeing the changes start to happen, you know, that makes, and I think, you know, I'm not, I think this is, it's absolutely right to kind of be, you know, it's sort of like being reflective and adaptive at the same time, isn't it? When you have a project on the go and the circumstances in which you can do it are changing so frequently, it's a natural thing to do. But yeah, it just feels so kind of easy to say, these are the rules, they're going to be the rules for the next 6 months. Anything we do exists within these rules, and that's that. And then as things change a lot, I think it does feel, you know, unsettling and kind of not necessarily in an actually bad way, because obviously it's good when things open up more. But yeah, definitely leads to more thought and, you know, more.
I think one of the, for what it's worth, one of the challenges, sort of thinking in more general terms, as things start to open up, and live performances begin to happen, as they have done, actually. And I think Snape have been running a wonderful series with actual audience members present. I think one challenge we're going to have to deal with as musicians and as an industry is, how do we get the balance right between digital and live, and how do we make those things work really well together? Because there's so many issues, like, you know, if you run, I put it this way, I think a lot of people have been trying to find a replacement for live, which in my opinion, I don't think is strictly necessary. I think we are going to go, you know, live concerts, they're completely irreplaceable. Those will come back somehow in some form at whatever time. So my question is, well, how do we bring what we've learned from the pandemic and make it like really work with live? And how do we price that? And how do we, you know, there's so many variables there. And I think that's already beginning to happen, isn't it? With, you know, as you were mentioning, the kind of subscription series stuff. And I think there's going to have to be a lot of experimenting with pricing. You know, everyone's kind of having to experiment with what, how is this going to sit alongside Netflix, where you can get an unbelievable amount, you know, get a huge amount of viewing for actually not that much. So, you know, how are our classical music things going to stand against that? And how do we want to play that in the industry? But I think that's an interesting route to think along, because I think it's a challenging one, but I think it'll yield some interesting results.
I completely agree, both with all of those questions, which are, I think, in the process of becoming clearer and being experimented with, aren't they? But in particular, the distinction between in-person events and kind of online content, I just think is really important, and also different kinds of events and different kind of content in within that as well, because, as you know, I do a lot of advocating for fair pay for musicians, and the more, and you know, I've been doing a lot of I released quite a, you know, a big blog post the other week about being paid. It had a sort of controversial title, something like "I don't deserve to be paid to play music" or something like that. So I was interested sort of exploring the issue in, you know, through social media, and you know, the notion that you know, it's about defining the differences. You know, nobody has a everyone gets in a muddle about paying for music, because you have amateur musicians who are absolutely, you know, should be out and performing and doing things, and that's, you know, nobody wants to stop that in the slightest. In fact, it should be more than encouraged. And similarly, when you get professional musicians doing things, you want them to be paid a professional fee and to not have all of the other kind of difficulties that come with acquiring that fee. And it is just about distinguishing between those different things. And the same is true online, I think, and this is what took a bit of ironing out. And again, we've had a few conversations about this with you and with other people on the live series that I was doing on Facebook, about ironing out what exactly kind of the purpose is of all of the content that was coming out, because we did see waves, didn't we, as lockdown started, of, you know, loads of people doing loads of stuff from home really quickly, and then some people who weren't comfortable with that kind of going, ooh, I don't know about doing that, but do I have to do that now? Is that what the music industry is now? Do I, you know, is that, do I become irrelevant if I don't do that? You know, and so we just saw all these kind of, this thought processes going through the minds of sort of musicians collectively about that. And as we go through this, I think we're finding a way through defining different types of content, both in person and online, and what they're for. And I think that's a really positive thing for the industry, because it helps to clear up some of those confusing issues, I think.
Yeah, I think so. It's hugely complex, isn't it? This question of well, both fee and how to make this kind of model work now. One thought I had that I'd love to see, to be honest, is something like, you know, if you want to go and hear someone at a concert hall, say one of the London concert halls, and you want to hear this recital, but you're not capable of traveling down there for whatever reason, or you live too far away, or you live abroad, you live in the States or whatever, and you still want to see this concert in that amazing hall. I'd love there to be an option for every single concert that you watch it online. And yes, for a small fee, otherwise no one will show up to the concert as well, potentially, or very few people. But at the same time, I think that fee should be set really quite low. I would say something around the sort of like iTunes song kind of cost. I mean, I can't say if that would even work as a business model. I'm just sort of plucking fingers out.
It all depends on the number of people that are doing it.
I'm just plucking figures out of my mind randomly. But I think it's got to be an amount that people won't think too much about. Because the second you start to, you know, if you're starting to charge, and I don't want to get into it, I don't want to sort of cause or anyone listening to freak out and yell at me on social media, but if it's priced too high, I think it will start, people will start to just think, well, for that same price, I could get this, you know, on another platform that has vast amounts. And, you know, we're talking about how do we sort of weigh those things up? But I think it would be nice to always have a sort of streaming alternative, because I've loved so many concerts that have been online, especially, like I said, the Wigmore ones and the Edinburgh ones. I've absolutely loved those. And particularly the Edinburgh ones, I wouldn't really, unless I was up there performing for something nearby, I wouldn't really get to an Edinburgh concert. So those were so fun to watch. I was so grateful to be able to watch those. But I think some kind of balance where you get a bit of both would be nice. So you've got the option, if you live nearby, of having the live event, but also if you can't, then, you know, wonderful to be able to access it online.
Well, I completely agree. And also, as I mean, obviously, I am a definite confirmed consumer of classical music. So that is, you know, that's my consumer profile, as it were. But as someone who lives in the Northeast, and so not near of the UK, not near London, and obviously nowhere near like America or Germany or Vienna or anywhere like that, the online option gives me access to things that I could never, or certainly would never see unless I was in the area. And, you know, if I wanted to, before I had my son, whenever my husband and I went on holiday, we always went to the opera in whatever city we were going to. And there is no way that having access to opera on the internet would stop me from doing that.
Exactly.
Yeah. I might, but but yeah, the access on the internet wouldn't, because they're two different experiences. And I love the idea. I mean, obviously, I run regional concert societies and so on. I love the idea of people all over the world being able to watch concerts happening in Hull, in the northeast of England, where I organise them, and where only really the people of Hull and the East Riding of Yorkshire at the moment view them.
I heard a really interesting thing that you might be interested to hear, and you may have heard this interview already, but there was a really great interview with Joanna McGregor the other day, who's head of piano at the Academy. And she was talking on this interview about how things might be different when we go back to live concerts. And she brought up this really good point, which was that for younger people, for younger audience members, going to a concert is as much a social thing as it is to hear the music. And you know, for a lot of them, just watching it at home on their laptop on a sofa is not really going to cut it. And it tended to be, you know, often, I'm not going to generalize too much, but it tends to be a slightly more elderly audience that will actually go to the concert in general. And I think that, like, now everything's changed, because I think if anything, the younger people are going to be absolutely wanting to go out to things. So we might find that they actually end up going out to the concert, and the opposite happens, because the more elderly audience members might be a little bit more nervous about actually going to a hall, going to a space where they're potentially going to, you know, be around a lot of other people. So Joanna's point was that we may see a real flip in how things work in that respect. Yeah. And I thought that was a really interesting way of looking at it. I'd never really thought of it like that, but I thought that was a really good point.
Well, certainly from the perspective of regional music clubs, the fact that almost our entire core audience is elderly and in the vulnerable category is a major problem when planning future concerts, not least the fact that the concert halls would be socially distanced anyway, obviously for very good reason, but, you know, there's that economic impact, and then there's the fact of the very high possibility that people actually won't want to go or won't feel safe going, especially at first, or, you know, whatever the circumstances might be. So there's a huge load of problems, I completely agree with that, actually, because on the flip side, there is no question that things being online makes them more accessible to people who wouldn't see them otherwise, and especially younger people who just consume such a lot online and who spend such a lot of time online. But also, I just think online performance is so accessible. I mean, for one of the concert series that I work for in Hull, we've done this project to get accessible concerts into the kind of normal flow of things. So we're trying to organise a parallel concert series to our... We run a traditional concert series on an evening. You've played in it before.
It was a joy.
Which, you know, has a good core audience of people who are mainly over 60, probably almost all over 50, and, you know, is like many concert series in that sense, starts at 7:30 and so on and so forth. And so we're trying to do a kind of daytime series alongside it, that where the programme is more or less the same, but you know, people with kids can go, people with disabilities are more able to go. It's not that they're not able to go in terms of being welcome at the evening concerts, but there are loads of practicalities to do with, they might be welcomed by us, but they might not be welcomed by the other people in the audience, and so on and so forth. Just the whole kind of feel around going to a classical concert is that it has to be so quiet and so, you know, almost like reverential. So, you know, we're trying to, you know, do this genuinely relaxed series in which people can have the same content, but in a different setting. And we planned all of this and did a pilot of it before lockdown. Luckily, the pilot happened in February, so I'm really glad that we managed to do that. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, the world has moved to such a vast amount more music being captured digitally. And that does everything for inclusion, because, you know, if I'd had all this digital content when my son was a baby and I just spent all my time kind of basically sitting and feeding him, now I can't watch it anywhere near as much as I want to, because I work all the time and then look after him the rest of the time, or sometimes it's the other way around, but you know, as a parent, you can't, I mean, I didn't go to anything in the evening for at least a year and a half after he was born.
Yeah. As you said, that is another prime demographic that I'm sure there's loads of people with very young kids that would love to be able to go to more, especially evening concerts, and me included. I've got four kids.
To things with your partners as well, because obviously, like, you know, for either of us to go out with our partners to something in the evening, you know, you've got to pay for the babysitter, you've got to even be possible to get a babysitter, you know, young ones. I mean, we never actually, that was an unseen thing about having a child that I didn't even really realize, was that our son just was not, it just wasn't possible to get a babysitter unless it was a grandparent, because he just sort of, I don't know, was just too young and didn't feel it would work, essentially. And then, you know, you've got the concert tickets, the travel, the so on and so forth, and, you know, you have to be really, really, really committed to going to something, to spend that much money and that much time on doing it. Whereas if you can watch a concert online, you can you know, you can do it while you're feeding a baby, you can do it when the kids are in bed, you can have a pizza, you can have a bottle of wine, whatever. The whole thing, including the ticket, could cost you an absolute fraction of the price. And obviously, you know, I just think that's a great thing to have that, to have both those things available, to be able to go and see it and have the occasion, but also, you know, to be able to see that music. Because ultimately, we just need people to be able to see music, don't we? And hear music.
Yeah, and if, especially if they really, if it's something, yeah, that's a great example of something that's a, it's, you know, online being a great solution for a limited period of time. Because obviously, when you've got kids, they are going to grow up and you will be able to go to live things again. It's what I was saying earlier about, we don't necessarily need a permanent online solution to replace live. That's not
absolutely necessity. Yeah.
But it's a wonderful extra thing to have that has so many benefits for different demographics at different points and for different reasons. And for that reason, I think it's really vital to make sure that we don't. I think it's very easy for us as musicians to, you know, as lockdown eases, and if it gets back completely to normal anytime soon, which would be lovely. I'm not sure how soon it will be, but you know, that is one of the big dangers, is that we just forget about what happened in terms of online and all the creativity that we had around that. So I just really hope that we do keep challenging the way we do things and searching for new ways to present. I mean, people have been wonderful about this kind of stuff previous to the pandemic, and we're really exploring interesting ways of presenting concerts. But I think this has been a real catalyst for that kind of thinking, and hopefully out of this will come some incredible new things, I think.
I think one of the worst things that could happen in general after the pandemic, if there is such a thing, is that we just go back to where we were before without any learning. I think the learning that we've done through this, both in terms of music and in terms of lots of other things, could be really valuable to us. We've talked about this from the point of view as an audience member. The industry itself and how it supports musicians and so on has probably some adapting to do to make this possible and viable and so on. But I think we are starting to see that, and I'm certainly, you know, part of that. Polyphony Arts is part of that. You're part of that too, I'm sure, with Stephen Hoff's project and other things. So it's, you know, it's exciting to see what the future holds.
Yeah, I think so. It's an exciting time. It's also, I guess, a nerve-wracking time, isn't it? Well, I mean, for many reasons.
Well,
for musicians, yeah, and artists in general, financially, it's very nerve-wracking, and especially as time progresses, it's, you know, it's increasingly worrying. So it's tricky, because it's quite hard to be creative when you're worrying about that kind of stuff too. So it's, you know, it's a very challenging time, and at lots of different levels, I think. But hopefully, like I said earlier, with you know, with limitation can often come a, you know, an interesting solution. So I'm excited to see what happens and what new initiatives people come up with. I think it's going to be quite a ride, I think.
I agree, yeah, and it's nowhere near, as lockdown starts to lift, it's really only the beginning, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on. It was such a pleasure to talk again.
Oh, thank you so much, Katie. It's been an honour. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening today. To find out what we're up to, do join our mailing list or follow us on social media. And if you'd like to support the podcast by buying me a coffee, you can do that on buymeacoffee.com. Thank you so much. See you next time.